Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, and I'm joined by two very special guests, Katie Gurin of 350 Humboldt. Hey, Katie.
Hello.
Hey. And Colin Fisk of the Coalition for Responsible Transportation Priorities.
Hi, Tom.
And so today we're having a pretty fun episode. We're talking about the Green New Deal. In particular, how we can downsize the Green New Deal from this national set of ideas or values or virtues and make it something that we can implement here in Humboldt County, either at a county level or a local government level. You know, how can we take meaningful climate action locally and how can we move to create a more just and equitable, clean, green economy locally? I guess for those who have been living under a rock or perhaps listen to too much Fox News and have a false impression about what the Green New Deal is, Colin, can you kind of outline what is the Green New Deal? And I understand that it means different things to different groups and there are various competing proposals, but what are the common core, what are the broad principles behind the Green New Deal?
Okay, well, I should start by clarifying that I haven't been part of any of those groups developing competing proposals for the Green New Deal, but
good disclaimer.
But I'll say that from my vantage point, it seems that I think the most formal sort of version of the Green New Deal was kind of a report that was issued by a group of Congress members a while back. But there have been, as you mentioned, sort of lots of different packages of proposals and principles and so forth issued under that title. I think the common themes are that we need to urgently and ambitiously address the climate crisis and sort of tackle all of the major sources of emissions. And we need to do it in an equitable way that addresses sort of the inequities of the crisis of both of impacts and of sources, and do it in a way that stimulates and supports our society and our economy rather than exacerbating existing problems. So that's sort of my very brief summary. Do you have stuff to add, Katie?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's great. And that really summarizes a lot of my thinking on it. I tend to think of the Green New Deal as a way for labor, social justice advocates, and economic justice advocates, and climate advocates to work together and toward common goals. Over the next few decades, we're going to have to basically transition off of fossil fuels and transition onto something better. That's going to take a lot of decommissioning oil and gas infrastructure, whether it's in home, your gas heater, or whether it's an oil refinery, and then transitioning on to something else, which is electrifying transportation, for example, and then building renewable energy and building infrastructure for active transport, that sort of thing. You know, it's going to involve actually like a lot of building stuff, which is going to take an expanded workforce. We have this great need for like a lot of workers and a lot of work in the society at the same time where we have a crisis in inequality and a real lack of family supporting jobs. So we totally have shared goals, and the Green New Deal is sort of a platform where we can bring these goals together.
I think that those were both really excellent overviews of the Green New Deal, right? We have two crises facing the nation at the same time, climate change and growing economic inequality, and we can tackle both at the same time and hopefully work to solve both. This has been something that's been largely on the national radar. We have a proposal put forward by Senator Markey of Massachusetts and AOC. Their proposal is what Donald Trump might talk about as the Green New Deal, because they actually put forward something into legislation that they are calling the Green New Deal. But there have been various proposals. Data for Progress had one. The Sunrise Movement is another. I think that the AOC Markey legislation kind of melds all of the ideas together into really concrete and specific legislative language. But this is a national conversation, as I just said, and I think that it's fair to say that things aren't doing super well at the national legislative level, right? We have historic impasses in Congress. We have a split Senate and House. So we have the House controlled by the Democratic Party, the Senate controlled by the Republican Party as of now. We are only seemingly able to pass spending bills, reauthorization bills, and some kind of other must-pass type legislation, defense reauthorization bills. We're not passing new, big, ambitious legislation, right? There's no more ESA, Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act type stuff going through. I'm interested in particular about how, if we can't trust our federal legislature to get this done, or the executive branch to do things under their more limited powers, what can we do locally? What can we do in the state of California to translate these principles and to get working now? Because climate change can't wait, right? We are digging a deeper and deeper hole for ourselves each year that goes by that we don't take meaningful action to address climate change. So with that long framing in mind, let's get to talking about how we can think about the Green New Deal here in Humboldt County. Colin, I know that this is an issue that you care very deeply about, which is transportation. It is the largest emission category in Humboldt County, according to the forthcoming Climate Action Plan. Just briefly talk about where are these emissions coming, particularly within the transportation sector, and what are the initial steps that we can do to get working to reduce greenhouse gas emissions?
Yeah, so you can break down transportation into a variety of subcategories. The biggest category of emissions is from private passenger vehicles, so just people driving around in their everyday lives. And that's where CRTP has focused a lot of its efforts, because that's the biggest chunk there. Basically, there are two steps that it's widely agreed are necessary to reduce transportation emissions quickly enough and substantially enough to thwart the most severe climate impacts. And that is mode shift, so shifting some of that travel away from cars and trucks and towards walking, biking, transit, and other forms of lower emissions transportation. And then the second thing is electrifying the trips that remain, so that we can power the remaining car and truck trips with hopefully clean renewable energy instead of with fossil fuels. And both of those things, there's a substantial role for the local government to play. Probably the biggest thing is in controlling a lot of how funds get spent on local transportation infrastructure. There's a lot of tough decisions to be made here, because we already have trouble maintaining this extensive system of roads that we have in the county. But really, one of the things that I think we need to do is prioritize infrastructure that serves safe and comfortable and convenient walking, biking, and buses, and all of the ancillary parts of that, making sure that people have access to where they want to go via those kinds of modes of transportation. And frankly, that might sometimes mean making it a little bit less convenient to just drive your personal vehicle, but that's going to be what's necessary to get that initial mode shift. And then the second aspect with electric vehicles is sort of easing the way and perhaps some direct stimulus of building out a good electric vehicle charging network.
So, Katie, I'd love to throw it to you if you have any additional thoughts on things that local governments can do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from transportation. And then also, you know, tie in that other angle, which is job creation, green, clean job creation.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would also say that as we're electrifying transportation, of course, high priority is making sure that electric cars are available to people of all income levels. So Colin recommended this thesis that's been really instructive to me by an HSU student, Chi-Wei Su, that covers some ways that locally we can make sure that electric vehicles are more accessible. So things like making sure charging stations are in areas near multifamily housing, also making sure that rebates and incentives are targeted toward like used vehicles instead of always targeting them towards new vehicles. Yeah, I think that's the big push. In terms of your second question about green jobs, I mean, there's so many. And if any of you are following the offshore wind talks from the Schatz Lab right now, they had a webinar on economic development from offshore wind, and that was really interesting. I mean, there's a huge potential for job growth there. In terms of other sectors, restoration jobs, which will help us adapt to climate change in some cases and then help with carbon sequestration, perhaps in others. Restoration jobs are a great way to create lots of jobs per dollar. And then there's just a ton of other work that needs to happen for this transition to occur. So whether that be renewable energy infrastructure, decarbonizing buildings, building charging stations, and sort of retrofitting streets for more active transport, building bike lanes, these sorts of things, so we can create jobs in all of these sectors.
The Transportation for America, which is a national advocacy organization, they have done a really interesting analysis of the stimulus spending that happened during the last recession. One of their takeaways is that spending on big, massive, expensive highway projects, which is a traditional stimulus thing, doesn't actually produce that many jobs per dollar. What produces a lot more jobs per dollar are the smaller, maybe less sexy spending things, but the kinds of things that we really need, building bike lanes, building sidewalks, just repaving roads, those kinds of smaller things that will be really critical in building out some of that green infrastructure we talked about actually produce more jobs also.
All of this sounds expensive. And one of the things that I think is difficult for all of us as we've been thinking about this is where to find the money, because this is going to involve pretty massive reinvestment in infrastructure creation. I don't think we ever ended up with Infrastructure Week through the Trump administration, but we're going to need a lot of dollars and cents. But let's maybe think about the things that local governments could do that are cheaper. What are some of the lowest hanging fruits that we could do that don't cost much money, but would yield a pretty good benefit? And I will throw one out here to start off with, which is local governments can help individuals make better choices by doing pooled buying. So this is the idea that you can have efficiencies of scale and you could get price reductions when you have larger orders. The county hasn't done this before, but there's nothing stopping it from collecting orders of customers all within the county for, let's say, green vehicles. We could make a mass order of Nissan Leafs through Nissan, and we could get a significant price reduction, or solar panels or anything else. So this is something that the government could do with a very few dollars, some staff time, that could really have a pretty big impact in reducing the price of solar panels, green car, whatever, for individuals. Let's throw out some other ideas of things that aren't super costly. What else can the government do that is cheap? Katie?
Well, we could immediately enact building code requiring all electric in new construction.
Is that going to be more expensive though, Katie?
No.
That was a softball, you know, just slam it out of the park.
It will be cheaper for developers. And existing California code requires on residences solar panels. This is a great way for folks to optimize distributed energy resources, and it'll be cheaper. And then we won't have to come back and retrofit those buildings for all electric in the coming decades. All electric homes are much safer. There's not the risk of asthma and other maladies caused by poor indoor air quality. So that's going to make you healthier, which will, if you have to translate that to dollars, you know, perhaps help you save on medical expenses. So yeah, this is really a win-win.
If we have the Humboldt Bay gas power plant, does forcing people to go over to electric make sense from a carbon perspective?
It absolutely does, because we have targets. We have local and state targets mandating that our electrical grid will be 100% renewable very soon. So locally, we have the RCEA has commitments to transitioning our electrical to renewable and clean by 2025, and hopefully local renewable and clean by 2030. And then in the state, we have a renewables portfolio standard, which mandates that the entire state's electrical grid has to be zero carbon by 2045. Yes, all electric is absolutely going to be cleaner very, very soon.
Perfect. Welcome to the Eco News Report. I have Katie Gurin of 350 Humboldt and Colin Fisk of the Coalition for Responsible Transportation Priorities here to talk about how to translate the principles of the Green New Deal into local action. All right, Colin, I know that you are passionate about zoning, which few people are. In what way can we change our zoning codes, our development standards, so that we have a reduction of greenhouse gases in the future? Because this also seems like something that could be a cheap fix.
That's true. Yeah. So there's a number of things that we could do, many of which boil down to encouraging infill development rather than more dispersed or sprawling development. And on a positive note, both the cities of Arcata and Eureka are moving in this direction already. So that's really nice to see. But, you know, that includes things like allowing mixed uses in developed areas so that we don't force the separation of commercial and residential uses which then makes it harder to get between them, makes it more likely that people are going to rely on cars. Also, allowing existing urban cores, allowing more density, which does mean things like sometimes it means taller buildings, but often it means things like requiring less parking or just not requiring them to put in parking to begin with, and instead relying on other modes of transportation. Because a lot of the requirements that exist right now, particularly at the county level, but also in some cases in the cities, make it virtually impossible to build anything at any significant density because you're required to put in so many parking spaces that you just fill up your lot. Removing those parking requirements is a really good first step.
So just briefly, why is density good for climate?
It's good for the climate because more sprawling development encourages and sometimes even requires travel by private automobile. If you live in a residential subdivision and you are miles from the nearest grocery store or a place that you might be employed, go to work, place that you might get services, and often those places also don't have good active transportation infrastructure, it's low enough density that it doesn't really make sense to run a bus there, then the only way to get a lot of places is to drive a car, as opposed to if you live in a place where there's a corner store that sells groceries and right down the block there's retailers selling other goods and office space upstairs and that kind of thing, often you can walk or bike or easily get origin to destination without getting in a car. And also, the more dense it is, the more people live and work in an area, the more financially viable it is to run buses, which is another alternative that drastically reduces greenhouse gas emissions.
We do face challenges from a local level that would be more easily solved if the feds could just get it together and act on climate change. What is the stuff that would be hard to get done? What can't we do at a local level?
Before we get to that, can I add one other thing that I think we can do at a local level?
Yeah, let's focus on the positive.
And I think this isn't exactly zoning, but it involves changing a little bit the way we approach public works. But if our local governments adopt standards that when they are already doing maintenance and repair work on roads, when they're repaving or fixing a road, filling in potholes, resurfacing, any of those kinds of things, if they adopt standards that say, well, we're already doing that, we will repaint some lines, we'll put in bike lanes, we'll put in some cases, even pedestrian lanes if there's not sidewalks. You can do a lot with paint that's pretty cheap and really cheap if you're already resurfacing or fixing up a road that can make a big difference in terms of access for alternative forms of transportation. So I just wanted to throw that out there also.
Well, I appreciate you focusing on the positive. And actually, before we get to the what are our challenges, let's have we missed anything about translating the Green New Deal locally? So Katie, you touched on jobs, and I think that all three of us are interested in the potential for this large offshore wind project to not only provide a couple of jobs with the creation and operation of it, but we could also have Humboldt County could be the hub of offshore wind energy development. Do you want to talk briefly about what are our kind of natural advantages that we have over our competition, like San Francisco?
Well, I would say if you want a really thorough explanation of this, I would definitely tune in to Schott's webinar series. So I'm not an expert on this by any means. But having listened to that webinar, I think the hope is that this area will be an offshore wind hub, so that, like you were saying, so that we will be able to keep jobs here related to offshore wind, that will be involved in things like research and development with HSU, that will be involved in manufacturing. So these sorts of things. The North Coast just has this world-class wind energy resource. So if I'm remembering correctly, we have some of the strongest, the best, I hate calling wind a resource, you know, I mean, it seems like a weird thing to say, but we have the best resource, I think, in the nation. So we have a great opportunity to bring jobs here and keep them.
Yeah, well, so when one of our advantages is that we don't have a bridge like the Golden Gate that would cross. And these wind turbines that we're going to put offshore are so big that they couldn't fit under the Golden Gate. So there are very few places on the West Coast that have the kind of natural port infrastructure that we do here in Humboldt Bay. So if we think that offshore wind is going to be a significant component of our renewable energy future, which it may be, then Humboldt County could be well positioned to take advantage of that. And hopefully everything works out, that fewer impacts. Yeah, hopefully everything works out and we can have a good source of clean green jobs here in the county.
So we're really fortunate in that we have community choice aggregation and we have local control of our energy. And so we have the Redwood Coast Energy Authority having all these programs to keep jobs and money and local, and then also invest in programs that will help us with this transition. So that's really great that we have that. So yeah.
Yeah. And we'll end the positive bit with this, which builds off your comment, which is we have better democratic control of our government at the local level. We have blockages on the federal level. We have historic partisanship and negative partisanship, which discourages deal making and makes it difficult to ever get major legislation passed there. But we don't have that here in Humboldt County. We have generally elected officials who believe in climate change and want to take action on it. We have a spirit in Humboldt County of getting things done. You know, we are forgotten by the rest of the country and the rest of California. So we are able to forge our own path here. And so if there's anything that gives me a lot of hope, it's that we can influence the direction and shape of our governments in a way that other people can't. People here care. And so we can take advantage of our natural resources. And one of those is our people. So with a hopeful bit, what are the challenges? So as I said before, part of the problem is potentially spending. If we're remaking an economy, that seems like it could be expensive. What are some of the other challenges towards addressing climate change purely on a local level?
Well, I think that they fall into two categories. One of them is, like you said, spending, that this will require a level of investment that we just can't fully raise at the local level. So we will need state and especially federal spending to do everything that we're going to need to do. And the other category of things that we can't fully do at the local level is regulatory. So there are large areas of regulation that are preempted by the state and the federal government that we are just not legally allowed to address. And so, like in the transportation sector, emissions from vehicles is a big one. So we will need the state and federal government to get more ambitious about regulating, you know, emissions. And California, to be fair, has been fairly ambitious. The federal government, not so much, but that's an area. And actually, those things overlap quite a bit too, because while we will need certainly additional spending, we also will need changes in the regulations about how we can spend the money that already comes from the state and federal government. So, for example, again, my sort of wheelhouse is transportation, and there's a lot of dollars that come from the state and federal government for transportation that we spend locally, but a lot of those you're not even allowed to use on transit or on bike and pedestrian infrastructure, and that needs to change. So I think those are the two sort of big categories. And to give a few specifics, infrastructure spending, fully building out, although there are cheap ways to do it, fully building out networks of safe and convenient bike, pedestrian, and transit infrastructure will require new spending and new changed regulations at the state and federal level. Also, investments in the transit system, for example, transitioning our fleet to electric buses, that's expensive. And to do that rapidly, we'll need probably some state or federal funds. And there's probably also for some of the other electrification infrastructure and some of the things that are going to go along with that. One thing that I think we could partially fund locally, but would also really benefit from more funds, is rebates around electric vehicles and electric bicycles. I'll throw that out there. I think this is really important, that e-bikes can be like a critical mode in a rural area like ours. One thing that I've just recently been looking into is that the state of Vermont actually has a pioneering e-bike program that has been quite successful at getting folks on bikes in a similarly rural and mountainous kind of region. And in fact, with much worse weather than we have here, So I think that that's a model to look at.
Having lived in Vermont, I can attest that Humboldt is very Vermont-like. So I think looking to them for inspiration is a good idea. Katie?
You know, I would just say that climate change, it's a really tricky problem and that you have to think at multiple scales. And I think that the degree to which we can, as a local community, work with other local communities to find openings for how we can share ideas and resources, I think that's really important. We can't tackle the problem of climate change as a local community, but we can definitely lead. So yeah, as much as possible, we want to be figuring about, you know, ways we can scale up our actions. But doing what we can always with what we have is really important.
Colin, when you were talking, I had a couple of thoughts, and maybe we can end the show with these thoughts. One is on spending, which is the good thing about being a rural county is that when tax dollars are spent here, generally we receive more in spending than we give to the state or federal government. So we should always be encouraging more spending, even just from a very self-interested standpoint, is the Bay Area and other parts of California largely subsidize the operation of rural governments in the state. So thank you to our friends in the Bay Area, but let's get those dollars. Let's bring that money up here and keep it up here. And then the second, which is on your comment about the difficulty of things being preempted by the federal government. And I've been thinking a lot about this recently, and I'm starting to come around to perhaps a more conservative position, which is we should give greater control to local and state governments to do what they want to do, really lean into this idea of federalism. You know, we have 50 states, we have 50 laboratories of ways that we could adapt and change. And maybe California can lead if we're given the opportunity. And so this is different than a lot of the typical left or liberal ideas about how climate change should be fought, which is from a national level. But, you know, if we can't anticipate that DC is going to lead, then they should get out of the way and let us lead. And so this really reinforces what are traditionally conservative ideas of states' rights or the powers of local government. So let's unleash California. And California's already done some great stuff. We have our own fuel mileage standards, which the Trump administration attempted to block. California is now pushing for all electric vehicles to be sold in the state by 2035. So California, if we lead, the rest of the nation follows because we are the largest market in the United States. So, you know, if California is mandating all electric vehicles, that's going to have ripple effects even in Alabama.
It sure is. I think you have a point there, although I would push back a little bit and say that part of the problem is that actually, a lot of the rules and regulations that are problems at the federal level, they're problems not because there are rules, but because they're the wrong rules. Like, for example, all of the rules around transit come from this perspective of transit should be able to pay for itself, which it doesn't, but no other form of transportation has ever paid for itself. And, you know, there's just kind of weird rule about that we have never held to highways or airplanes or anything like that. So I think we have to change the rules, maybe more than eliminate the rules, but just my perspective. And I will add just one other timely bit here about transit is that CRTP has teamed up with HCOG and the Western Transportation Institute, which is a national expert in rural and small town transit systems, to study transportation, public transportation in McKinleyville, and look at ways that can be improved. And so I would encourage anybody who lives or works in McKinleyville or visits there regularly to check out the website, which is McKinleyvilleTransitStudy.com, and provide us with some feedback about how transit could be improved there and the particular conditions in McKinleyville. This could be a first step towards some of these things we've been talking about.
All right. Well, I would really like to thank my two guests today, Katie Gurin of 350 Humboldt. Katie, where can people find information about 350 Humboldt if they want to get engaged with the local climate activism?
We have a website. So if you just Google 350 Humboldt, it'll come up. You can also find it through the 350.org website as well. So yeah, from our website, you can find out more about our campaigns, and there's a sign up so you can receive email updates for all of our meetings and events. We have a great speaker series as well. You can also find us on social media. So we're on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook.
All right, Colin, if someone's listening to this from their car and they really hate that they're in their car and want to create a world that requires them to be in their car less often, how can they find out about the Coalition for Responsible Transportation Priorities?
So our website is transportationpriorities.org. And you can go there. You can, as Katie mentioned, also you can sign up for our email list. We also have a weekly North Coast transportation newsletter that's comes out that you can sign up for. You can join the coalition, which we are always looking for new members, and find out a lot more about what we've been doing. So I would say start there. We're also on Facebook and Instagram too.
All right. And if you want more information about how our natural and working lands can help combat climate change, check out EPIC's work at wildcalifornia.org. Thank you all for joining the show. And thank you all for listening. This has been another Eco News Report. Join us on This Time and Channel next week for more environmental news from the North Coast of California.